Rachel was born in the Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts. It was known as the region of the five colleges: Amherst, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, Smith, and the University of Massachusetts, and it employed 2,000 faculty to teach 25,000 students. She grew up in a world of coffee shops, B&Bs, wide town commons, and clapboard houses with wraparound porches and musky attics. In autumn, leaves fell by the tubful and choked the streets, spilled onto sidewalks and clogged fence holes. Some winters, snow encased the valley in silence so dense it became its own sound. In July and August, the mail carrier rode a bicycle with a bell on the handlebar, and the tourists arrived for summer stock theater and antiquing. Her father's name was James. She knew little else about him. She recollected that his hair had been dark and wavy, and his smile sudden and unsure. At least twice he'd taken her to a playground with a dark green slide where the Berkshire clouds hung so low he'd needed to wipe the swing free of condensation before he could place her on it. On one of those trips, he'd made her laugh, but she couldn't recall how. James had been an instructor at one of the colleges. She had no idea which one, or if he'd been an adjunct, an assistant professor, or an associate on tenure track. She didn't even know if he taught at one of the five colleges. He could have been at Berkshire or Springfield Technical, Greenfield CC or Westfield State, or any of a dozen other colleges and junior colleges in the region. Her mother was teaching at Mount Holyoke when James left them. Rachel was just short of three and could never say with certainty if she'd borne witness to the day her father walked out of the house, or if she'd just imagined it to suture the wound his absence left behind. She heard her mother's voice coming through the wall of the small house they'd rented that year on Westbrook Road. "Do you hear me? If you go out that door, I will expunge you." Shortly thereafter, the bump of a heavy suitcase on the stairs out back, followed by the snap of a trunk closing, the rasp and whistle of a cold engine clamoring to life in a small car, then tires crunching winter leaves and frozen dirt, followed by silence. Maybe her mother hadn't believed he'd actually leave. Maybe once he had, she'd assured herself he'd return. When he didn't, her dismay turned to hate, and her hate grew depthless. "He's gone," she said when Rachel was about five and had begun asking persistent questions about his whereabouts. "He wants nothing to do with us, and that's okay, sweetie, because we don't need him to define us." She got down on her knees in front of Rachel and tucked an errant hair behind her ear. "Now, we won't speak of him again, okay?" But of course, Rachel spoke of him and asked about him. At first, it exasperated her mother. A wild panic would find her eyes and flare her nostrils. But eventually, the panic was replaced with a strange, tiny smile. So tiny, it was barely a smile at all, just a slight uptick of the right side of her mouth that managed to be smug, bitter, and victorious all at the same time. It would be years before Rachel would see the onset of that smile as her mother's decision, whether conscious or unconscious, she'd never know, to make her father's identity the central battleground in a war that colored Rachel's entire youth. Her mother promised to tell her James's last name on her 16th birthday, provided Rachel showed a level of maturity that would suggest she could handle it. But that summer, just before she turned 16, Rachel was arrested in a stolen car with Jared Marshall, whom she'd promised her mother she was no longer seeing. The next target date was her high school graduation. But after an ecstasy-related debacle at the semi-formal that year, she was lucky to graduate at all. If she went to college, then, a community college first to get her grades up, then a real one, her mother said, maybe then